From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Whitmer reopens talks with Enbridge about a Line 5 tunnel. Environmental groups say first shut down the pipeline, then talk to Enbridge.
I mean, the key thing for Governor Whitmer is to negotiate from a position of strength. She should take action, and she can take action now in the easement.
Dangerous glass pieces strewn along a beach at the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore.
Definitely it was deliberate. There's no way that thousands of shards of glass could wash up out of Lake Michigan.
The Detroit ham salesman who came up with the idea of the spiral cut ham.
One night he had a dream that there was a better way to slice the ham.
Plus teacher evaluations and sex education in the era of Me Too. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has reopened talks with Enbridge about that proposed tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac for its Line 5 pipeline. That's according to a report in the Detroit News. It comes after the governor issued an executive directive in late March ordering all state agencies to halt action on the tunnel. Here now is Mike Schreiberg, Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Office. Mike, what was your reaction when you first heard this news?
Well, there was some surprise, of course, although the fact that the governor is talking to Enbridge is not surprising. I mean, you know, as the governor, she has a responsibility to reach out to different stakeholders. But the fact that she seems open to a protracted negotiation, that was surprising. And the key question is, how is this different than the flawed strategy that Governor Snyder went down? That was not clear based on the article.
And we know that the Snyder administration estimated it would take some 7 to 10 years to get a tunnel built. And Governor Whitmer told the Detroit News editorial board, if talking with Enbridge helps get that pipeline out of the water sooner, then it's worth it. So what's wrong with her talking with Enbridge to try to speed up the process? I mean, isn't dialogue a good thing?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with dialogue. But just remember, the governor was elected in part on a platform that said she would shut down Line 5 as soon as possible. Right. And what we're seeing today is more discussions the way to get to that. That's not clear to us. And remember, the tunnel is really a separate issue than what's happening right now. There is a pipeline that's sitting right in the Straits of Mackinac. The governor has the power, the legal and moral authority to actually take action on it. The question is she going to do it? The ball is very clearly in her court.
Even as she campaigned saying that she was going to get that pipeline out of the straits, she never really addressed the tunnel, right, or directly commented about the tunnel idea.
Yeah, I think she avoided that question. And I think that in some ways is okay. If Enbridge really wants to build a tunnel, they should propose that. What the Snyder administration did was give them a sweetheart deal that allowed for basically the government to own it in particular ways and allowed it to get built, potentially built, at least, over a very long period of time with no guarantee that it would ever be built or that Line 5 would be shut down. That wasn't a good deal. If Enbridge actually wants a tunnel, they should use the existing laws and they should do that. But that's very separate than what happens with the current state of Line 5 and what happens. And the governor should take action on that immediately.
Certainly, we know that the law that created the authority to oversee construction of this tunnel to replace the pipelines was passed during the last lame duck session. Attorney General Dana Nessel issued a legal opinion about that law last month, saying it's unconstitutional, which Enbridge and many Republicans in Lansing beg to differ, which means it's all likely to land in court and drag things out. So given all of that, isn't Governor Whitmer talking with Enbridge likely to produce some kind of faster resolution than not talking?
It could. I mean, the key thing for Governor Whitmer is to negotiate from a position of strength. She should take action, and she can take action now in the easement. Then she would come at it from a position of strength and can then work with Enbridge. If she's just doing it just to talk again, what's the difference from Governor Snyder besides some campaign promises? That's the key point. And we've been advocating for her. Take action now. Revoke the easement that allows Line 5 in the Straits. It shouldn't have been given in the first place. It's been violated multiple times. Then you can talk to Enbridge about if they want to build a tunnel, they can propose it. But negotiate from a position of strength, not weakness. That should be the lesson the governor learned from Governor Snyder.
You say, you made that point about that the governor could secure the energy supply of the Upper Peninsula even by ending action on the pipelines right now. And that's been one of the big arguments amongst Republicans in Lansing. And you know, so how would she do that? How would you secure the energy supplies and needs of the Upper Peninsula?
Yeah, so Line 5 provides some of the propane for the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, or the raw materials for that. You could actually provide that same amount of propane. Instead of using the pipeline, you can use trucks or you can use rail. And the price difference would be something that's not even noticeable by UP customers.
And isn't that having it on roads or by rail, doesn't that present its own set of dangers?
Oh, absolutely. But when you compare it to the existential risk to the Great Lakes that Line 5 poses, it's not a comparison that is one of concern. Remember, propane gets to households and things already by truck. You're just talking about moving some more of the raw materials in that way. So yes, there is a marginally increased risk, but on balance, when you compare that to the risk of to the Great Lakes of Line 5, it's not even a close comparison.
So what you're saying is pull the plug on the pipeline.
Absolutely. We know that the governor can do that right now. Alternatives exist. She can secure the energy supply for the UP in short order and do that. Then you can negotiate over the future of that from Enbridge, but do it from a position of strength, not weakness.
So what do you make of what we've kind of seen just shaping up since the beginning of the year when we get a new governor, we get a new attorney general, that ruling from Attorney General Nessel? So what is all of this saying to you?
Well, so that ruling from Attorney General Nessel, which I believe was the correct ruling, that really sort of cleared the underbrush is the way I think about it. It sets the stage for the governor to take action not tied by the poor actions of Governor Snyder. So that's it. So the ball is so clearly in the court of Governor Whitmer right now. The question is, will she take action or will she spend more time in these negotiations with Enbridge?
What would you say to her if you could talk to her right now?
Well, I'd say that she's got the responsibility. She has the legal authority, and she has the ability to protect the Great Lakes by taking action right now on Line 5. Let Enbridge propose some longer-term solution. A tunnel could be part of that. It could not. But don't make that a condition of protecting the Great Lakes today.
That was Mike Schreiberg, Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Office. Ryan Duffy, the spokesman for Enbridge, which is one of our corporate sponsors, sent us this statement. We continue to provide information to the governor's office and to seek clarification from the administration on a path forward for the tunnel project. We believe the project is the best way to protect the waters of the Great Lakes while ensuring families, manufacturers, and other businesses safely receive the energy transported through Line 5. We also reached out to Governor Whitmer's office for comment, but we did not hear back. It was a shocking moment as staff at the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore discovered pieces of broken glass strewn along a beach. The dangerous shards appear to have been carefully, deliberately placed there. Scott Tucker is with us. He's superintendent of the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. Scott, how much glass was there and how large was the area where it was thrown about?
It's sort of mind-boggling. We have probably, as of today, picked up over 5,000 glass shards. And these are glass shards the size of a quarter up to a silver dollar and down to, you know, the size of your fingernail. And they're spread out along the Good Harbor Beach within the northern section of Sleeping Bear Dunes, a good 400 yards along the lakeshore.
So I guess I'll ask the question, do you believe this was deliberate as opposed to just washing up from the lake?
Definitely it was deliberate. There's no way that thousands of shards of glass could wash up out of Lake Michigan. Somebody deliberately broke them and deliberately walked the beach and dropped them.
You know, 5,000 pieces that you've picked up so far, my jaw hits the ground. And I stop, Scott, and I think about, you know, you break a plate or a glass in the kitchen or drop a glass on the bathroom floor, and you are never really sure you've got the pieces. You know, you sweep and sweep. How do you clean this up and feel confident people will be okay to walk barefoot on that stretch of beach?
You know, that's the challenge we're tasked with here. If you just take the weather last Saturday along that same shoreline, we had 3-4-foot tall waves crashing into the beach. And so the fear is how many pieces of glass are now 10, 20, 30 feet offshore, buried in sand and buried under the water, and how many other locations they're transported in the beach, as well as one storm this summer could unearth another piece of glass. For a beach that thousands of people visit in the summer, barefoot and on their beach towels and recreating in the park, it's a pretty scary thing. And the last thing I want to do is put up a big warning sign that says, keep your shoes on when you're at the beach. But unfortunately, that's what we did on Monday morning, is we placed warning signs up on Good Harbor Beach to keep your shoes on.
Any leads on who may have done this and why?
Your guess is as good as mine. It boggles my head and it boggles our law enforcement rangers' heads of why someone would deliberately spread glass. Over the last day, folks have come to the idea that someone is seeding it for beach glass. Well, a $20 rock tumbler will get you beach glass. Dropping thousands and thousands of shards on a beach, that is malicious intent.
What was your first feeling when you heard this news?
You know, my first feeling is anger, frustration. You know, this is a beach that I take my kids to, that visitors take their kids to, and locals spend time on. And the fact that any visitor that comes to the National Lakeshore has to worry about stepping on a piece of glass, cutting their foot, and having a negative recreational experience, that impacts everybody in the region.
So I take it investigation is continuing, but this is going to be tough to try to track down, isn't it?
That's exactly it. You know, tracking down, unless somebody saw somebody walking the beach and dropping glass, it's going to be really difficult. What we are trying to do is at least identify a time frame right now. That beach was under ice up until two and a half weeks ago. And so we're putting out the question of, did anybody walk that beach before Christmas and see glass? Or is it something that's happened in the last couple of weeks? And from there, we're also talking with the other local law enforcement agencies to see if there's similar things happening in other locations. We had a similar incident to this in the fall of 2017 at another beach within Sleeping Bear, not to the same quantity that we have found in Good Harbor, though.
Meantime, cleanup continues.
That's right. Our priority right now is picking up as many pieces of glass on the beach as possible.
Scott Tucker, superintendent of the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore, where crews have already cleaned up over 5,000 pieces of shattered glass deliberately spread along the beach. Thanks so much for talking with us, and best of luck with that cleanup.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up this Sunday, the centerpiece of many Easter feasts across the country will be a big spiral-cut ham. Well, it turns out we have a Michigander to thank for that. Stay with us. We're going to ham it up after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history, thanks to our partners at the Michigan History Center. This coming Sunday is, of course, Easter Sunday, and along with baskets of chocolate bunnies and Easter eggs, it's a pretty safe bet a spiral-cut ham is going to make an appearance in many homes. As you slice away at that ham, we need to give a hat tip to the Detroit ham salesman who invented the spiral-cut ham. Kim Severson of the New York Times wrote about the ham world's equivalent of pop music, quoting here, the spiral-cut ham, sweet, approachable, and easy to eat. Kim is with us now. Good to have you on Stateside, and I understand you've spent time in Michigan before heading off to the New York Times. So welcome back to the air in Michigan.
Oh, very glad to be here. Thanks.
What got you thinking, let's trace the rise of the spiral-cut ham?
Well, I've been a food writer for many, many years, and as you know, the holidays come around, Thanksgiving, Easter, Christmas, Passover, and as a food writer, you have to come up with some interesting new thing to write about each year. And I recently moved to the American South. I live in Atlanta. I still write for the New York Times, but I'm their national food correspondent now. And in Atlanta, everyone eats spiral-cut hams, and honey-baked hams specifically. So it was my turn in the Easter barrel, as it were, and my editor said, well, what do you got for Easter this year? And I said, I am fascinated with honey-baked hams. I don't know why everybody here has them. I didn't really know a lot about them. I said, we are going deep on spiral-cut hams, and I just was fascinated. And then I came across this great Detroit angle.
So before we get to that angle, it's probably good for us to have a minute or so of Ham 101 so we can understand how the spiral-cut ham came to be. So give us a quick reminder of the differences between a fresh ham, a country ham, a city ham, and then the spiral-cut.
Okay, so the ham is, comes from a large cut of the pig. So you take that hindquarter ham cut, and you can bake it in the oven just like that. That's a fresh ham. It comes out more like a pork roast, really, if you bake it, mm-hmm. than what a lot of us think of as ham in terms of, you know, that would be on your lunch meat sandwich. So that is the first step in the ham, the fresh cooked ham. If you take that ham and you brine it and possibly smoke it a little bit, within a few days, you've got what we call a city ham. It's basically a brined, a cured ham. So that's more the pinkish ham. Often they'll put some nitrates in it to give it that pinkish color. These hams are everything from the mass-produced, cheapest supermarket ham you could get, which is usually injected with water as well as brine, might not be put over smoke. The city ham can increase in quality if you start with a pig that's got a good pedigree and you take some care with its brining and some smoking, then you've got a more elevated city ham that will cost more money, and there are a lot of small producers who are doing that with ham. Now, if you take that fresh ham, that fresh cut of pork, and you rub some salt and spice onto it and you put it in over some smoke, and then you let it hang for 6, 8 months, a year or two, you have a country ham, and the water evaporates from that, the moisture evaporates from that ham, the salt cures the meat, and it gets a very complex and funky and lovely flavor. This is a really dense ham. This is, if you think about prosciutto or an Iberico ham from Spain, country hams are sort of the American version of that, and they're usually best sliced really thinly, put inside a biscuit, or you can, you know, do it as like charcuterie if you're at a fancy restaurant. And they can be very salty, and so some country hams end up fried and turned into breakfast with red-eye gravy.
Mm.
So that's your span of ham.
All right. So that brings us to this Detroit ham salesman.
Right. So in the 1930s, and there was a company that it was off on, I think it might have actually been Fenkel Road for fans who really want to get deep, but there was a honey-baked ham store, and it was not what we think of as honey-baked today. And there was a fellow who was a ham salesman, and at that time at drugstores, they had the soda fountains, and you would get a sandwich. And so his job was to go around and try to convince the soda fountain clerks to buy his brand of ham. And so his thing was that he would go and slice it into sandwiches and try to sell ham wherever he could. And a lot of it was the lunch counter trade.
Yes. And what was his name?
Oh, Harry Hohnsellar. H-O-E-N-S-E-L-A-A-R.
Harry Hohnsellar. So he's...
Yes. So Harry Hohnsellar is just trying to make a living selling this ham. And he was kind of known for his knife skills, apparently. He could, you know, would go in with his ham and, you know, try to sell them and do food shows and take it around to the diners and the lunch counters. He thought there had to be a better way to demonstrate the ham so he could sell more ham. So his family says that one night he had a dream that there was a better way to slice the ham. So he used a tire jack and a pie tin and a piece of washing machine motor and a knife, and he fashioned the world's first spiral ham slicer. And the contraption sort of lifted, the blade was perpendicular. He'd put the ham standing upright on this plate, and he used this motor to kind of lift the ham as this oscillating blade sliced it. And it slices against the bone, so you, and as the ham moved up, you would get the spiral cut. Well, this just revolutionized his ham sales. Everybody wanted to come see the contraption. He perfected it, so he filed a couple of patents on it, one of which expired in the 1980s, the last one, and that's when the spiral cut ham world exploded.
I love the way you described it, Kim. The spiral ham gold rush was on.
Yes, it was, because then everybody could buy one of these machines, and other companies started making them, and we had spiral cut hams as we know it. Now, interestingly enough, the family that owned that original honey-baked ham store, the husband died, the wife took it over. She really didn't want to deal with it. So Harry Hohnsellar, went back in the 50s and said, I'll tell you what, I'll buy the honey-baked ham store, and started to build this business. Now, there was a good 30 years between when he bought the ham store and when the patent expired. So for 30 years, he had a lock on spiral-cut hams.
Mm.
And he began to open ham stores regionally and expand them. He had four daughters, and as he got older, he divided up the country into four chunks, and each one got a territory. At the time, these were run more by their husbands than by them, but the honey-baked ham store, as we know it, grew out of that. And so now I think there are 440 or so honey-baked ham stores around the country. The granddaughter of one of his daughters ended up in charge of the company. There was some consolidation that happened and some squabbling in her family, and some of the families didn't really want to deal with it. So the one granddaughter consolidated it all. She moved headquarters to a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia. And the honey-baked ham store still maintains this almost iconic status among people. And it's very interesting when you go there. They hand-cut all the hams. And then they have people called master glazers who take this mixture of sugar and a little honey powder and some very kind of clove-scented spice and sprinkle it onto each ham. And then they have these blow torches and they hand glaze every ham that goes through the store. Now, Christmas is the number one time.
Oh, yeah. And we here in Michigan, certainly in the Detroit area, where they used to have their headquarters, it used to be in Oakland County, but the lines are long.
Yes. Now, I have a question. Somebody wrote to me after I did this story and said they don't like the honey-baked ham, but they like a spiral-cut ham, but they put a Werner's glaze on it. And I had never heard of that. But down in the South here, of course, dumping a can of Coca-Cola and some cloves onto a ham and baking it is one way to glaze it. But the Werner's glaze, I thought, what a Detroit-specific thing. Have you ever had a Werner glazed ham?
I have not, but I've heard of it. And you know, in Detroit, I mean, people use Werner's for everything.
As well,
they use it for medicine.
Werner. Yeah. I have great memories of Werner's floats as a kid.
Absolutely. And one final note on the ham. I know that you write in your story, which is really worth looking up at the New York Times website, because it's a great piece, how there was actually like ham espionage, that a mole came from a competitor to check out the Detroit equipment. And that's when he realized you had to have some sweet with that ham. It just didn't work if it didn't have some sweet.
Yes, it was a Vermont ham maker who wanted to get in on the spiral cut craze and see if it was worth it. They sent a man with a ham to Detroit. They liked the spiral cut. The guy came back and said, yeah, this will work, but you've got to have some sweet component to that ham. And the people in Vermont were proud of their smoked ham. They used corn cobs and a certain kind of sawdust to make this smoky flavor in their ham, and they did not want to pollute it with something sweet. Well, the spiral cut hams did not sell that year. The next year, they realized that the honey-baked people were onto something, so they developed a maple syrup glaze that they use, and now their spiral cuts are selling like crazy. But that funny combination of, we don't really think of meat and sweetness together that much, so the idea that you would have the sweet, sugary component to ham, now it's hard to think of something without it. You know, we put pineapple on hams, and we do lots of things to sweeten ham. But it was a marriage that certainly wasn't made by the honey-baked ham people, but was indeed popularized by them.
Well, it'll get you in the mood for that Easter spiral-cut ham, I'm going to tell you that. Kim Severson, her national food correspondent of the New York Times. And thanks to you, we now know that we can thank Detroit ham salesman Harry Hahnseller for this mainstay of our dinners. Kim, thanks. It was a blast to talk with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Another great thing to come out of Detroit. I love it.
The Michigan Senate has voted to delay planned changes in teacher evaluation standards. These changes put more emphasis on student test scores when evaluating teacher performance, but the Senate's voted to postpone that change for another school year. Tying teacher evaluation to student growth and assessment scores, it's controversial. Critics say it's unfair, doesn't account for factors outside the classroom. Backers say data is the best way to hold teachers accountable for progress, or lack of it, in their classrooms. Michigan Radio's education commentator is Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz, who's here with us now via Skype. What do teacher evaluations look like at most Michigan schools?
Well, it's a little bit of a buffet, and most evaluation platforms center around the standards that a teacher has to, like, ought to be able to do, such as like lesson planning, what can you deliver content well, or classroom environment, are the students engaged? So in Michigan, like, schools are allowed to pick from a list of recommendations from the state, and so each school basically picks an evaluation platform, or maybe a combination of platforms that fits their needs in their district.
So who does the evaluation, and how often do they happen, and how much do they differ from district to district?
So most of the time it's the principal of each school. That's part of their duties to evaluate the teachers. So the teachers have to be evaluated at least twice in a school year.
All right. And is it very much from district to district?
Yeah, it varies from person to person. So it depends on your principal, the type of evaluation that you're going to get, which is what some of the controversy is about.
So if I'm a principal in charge of evaluating a teacher, what are the factors that I am weighing to judge whether or not that teacher is effective?
Well, it depends. So now you might have a rubric in front of you based on the standards that you're picked. But it might also depend on your teaching style. And you might go in saying, well, she's not doing things the way I think that she should be doing it when the other teacher is doing the way I think that it should be done. So it's not very clear and it's not very clean.
All right, let's get the take from one of our Michigan teachers. This is Carrie Slay, who's a science teacher at North Huron Schools in Kindy.
It's become much more of a stick to punish people. People are less concerned about where do I need to grow personally? Where do I need to improve? And they're more concerned about, okay, I need to check all these boxes when my principal or whoever is in here observing this particular lesson and this particular class.
So Matinka, what is it about these evaluations that as they currently operate that feels like a stick to teachers?
Yeah, and you hear it in her voice and the fact that it's frustrating because the evaluator comes in and, you know, they only see a slice. But then they give you feedback or they give you a laundry list to do based on that slice that they see. And so you might go back and think to yourself, ah, but I already do that. You just didn't see it today. It might feel like a stick because you might get marked down because you did not perform a specific standard that the administrator was able to see that day.
Now, evaluations of teachers aren't anything new, but there's been a kind of a paradigm shift in how high the stakes are for teachers. Can you talk about that shift?
Well, the biggest problem is that the laundry list has gotten so much longer. So it's really, really difficult to perform each one of those items well. And also it makes it really, really difficult when the test scores are just so prominent in your teacher evaluation.
How much do they factor in?
The test scores factor in about 40%, like student performance, about 40% of your evaluation. So imagine this, Cindy, that one year you have a group of students who have just this, are super needy and have big socio-emotional problems or issues. You know, your evaluation standards do not change. You still have to meet those standards. And the teacher next door might have the kids you had last year that you prepared really, really well. And so now their scores will count for her evaluation.
All right, let's talk a bit about what it feels and looks like from the other side of this evaluation equation as a principal or the administrator who is judging these teachers. Here's Deb Asano, who's an associate superintendent at Marquette Algeresa, who's talking about evaluations.
If we're going to follow short, how do we shore that up? That's what it is more than gotcha. And right. I think whenever it's used as a gotcha, that we get angst and difficulty and it's teacher versus administrator, and that's no good.
How have these high-stakes teacher evaluations, Matinka, changed the roles of administrators within schools and in dealing with their teachers?
It has completely changed because it's no longer a mentorship. It's definitely a them versus us mentality. The funny thing is, I just read a study about how teachers perceive versus how administrators perceive this evaluation process. For the most part, administrators believe that, you know, they do provide the critical thinking piece that the teachers need, and they do improve, and they try to use evaluation to make consistent decisions across every classroom so they can see the same things. But on the other hand, teachers are like, nah, it's not. It does not capture what I am teaching. The teachers really believe that it's not an impartial exercise. Like Deb said, sometimes it's seen as a gotcha based on favoritism. And so it's just not an authentic, it's not in a realistic way to assess teachers.
So to this point of tying and how closely a teacher evaluation should be tied to student test scores, you know, a lot of teachers feel it is not fair, but shouldn't there be some way to hold teachers accountable for how well kids are learning in their classrooms?
For sure. I mean, most teachers want to be evaluated. Most teachers want to see how they're growing as professionals. However, the way that the evaluation works, it's just not meeting the mark. So yeah, just like you can assess a student without using a test, you can definitely assess a teacher without using these strict evaluation pieces. However, there is not enough time. When you have to evaluate most of the teachers in your building, even the ones that you've already deemed defective, it makes it so the principals have even a longer laundry list. They're the busiest people in the schools for the most part, yet their job is to sit down with a teacher confidently and calmly and try to bring them to a different level of performance. So it's not a realistic way to assess a teacher, assess an administrator, or assess the school for that matter.
If you could design a better way to evaluate teachers, Matinka, what would it look like?
Well, for one, I would definitely take away the test score variable, because whether you call it student growth, student achievement, student success, it is all about test scores. And once I eliminate that, I would definitely make it more peer review. Teachers are more comfortable with their own peers. Often administrators are not very experienced teachers themselves. They're not master teachers themselves, and yet they're then meant to evaluate mastery. So it would be a completely different relationship if your own peers would be the ones evaluating your performance rather than a person that is so busy that they don't have the time to really go through all that paperwork and all of that exercise to evaluate your progress.
Michigan Radio's education commentator, Matinga Ragatz. As always, Matinga, thank you so much.
Thank you so very much.
After the break, how schools are rethinking sex education in the Me Too era.
And it really is not about sex. It's about power. It's about disrespect. It's about the kinds of relationships that we want to build.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The hashtag MeToo movement put a very bright and harsh spotlight on how sexual harassment and violence has permeated American culture. Many believe changing that culture means changing the way schools teach about sexuality and consent. State Senator Curtis Hertel is in that camp. The Lansing Area Democrats' new bill would require Michigan schools to include training in consent as part of sex education classes. He says curricula have not caught up to the realities that are facing young adults.
1/4 of college women and 1 out of every 20 college men will be a survivor of sexual assault while they're on our college campuses.
4 other states have adopted similar laws, and Governor Whitmer supports Hertel's bill. Let's talk more about sex education in this era of Me Too. Here now is Wendy Sellers. She's a sexual health education consultant and the author of Puberty, The Wonder Years. And she's with us via Skype. Wendy, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you for having me today. It's an important topic, so I'm pleased to talk with you about it.
Terrific. And also, we want to welcome Emma Davis Rodak, who is a senior in the Ann Arbor Public School System, and she sits on the district's Sexual Health Education Advisory Board. Emma, great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
All right. Well, let's start, Wendy, with asking you, as you think about the Me Too movement and where we've come since that became top of mind to much of America, has it affected what schools are doing when it comes to sex ed?
Yes, it has. I think it has raised a lot of awareness, and it has also prompted a lot of conversations. That has resulted in schools being more aware of the fact that they need to update their curriculum to help young people be better equipped to avoid sexual violence in all its forms. And some schools have started working on that, but many have a long way to go.
And are you seeing more districts trying to incorporate lessons about consent into their sexual health curriculum?
Yes, schools are talking about that. Unfortunately, I don't know of a lot of schools who have actually gotten to the point of doing adequate updates to their curriculum to include those topics in a very sequential manner, starting with the younger grades and continuing through high school.
All right. Well, as we talk, we're going to offer up some ideas. First, now I want to turn, though, to Emma Davis Rodak, a senior in the Ann Arbor Public School System, and you're part of the effort to make changes in the sex ed curriculum in Ann Arbor. So can you give us some examples of changes you're pushing for?
So this girl, Sabina Fall, who was in my position last year, she was pushing to make like a curriculum that makes it safe for teachers to talk about consent in areas besides just health classes. So she was talking about, like, in history classes, talking about, like, the genocides and the rapes that happened in history, and especially in American history. She was talking about in literature classes and, like, talking about consent in books, because she personally had a lot of experiences where, like, she would be in a class and they would have a scene that, like, sexual assault happened in like, a book, and they just wouldn't talk about it because they didn't know how. So that was one of the really cool things I saw. And then we also have been working on, like, more comprehensive sex ed for disability people in, like, special ed classes and stuff, because they do have a, like, way higher rate of sexual assault because of the position they're put in. they need like someone to like sometimes help them out with things.
Sure.
It's really dangerous for them if they can't trust that person, and if that person, if they don't know where the boundaries are with that person.
Boy, that idea of taking consent and kind of teasing it out and unwinding it from the topic of sex. Wendy, how important is that?
It is vital, and I think Emma raises some great points about it needing to be taught across our school day and across our culture. This is a cultural, societal norm that we allow people to verbally and physically assault, and it really is not about sex. It's about power. It's about disrespect. It's about the kinds of relationships that we want to build, and so equipping people to talk about it not as part of sex ed is really important, especially since in Michigan, our state laws allow parents to opt their kids out of sex ed lessons for any reason. So if we only teach it in sex ed, many children will not get those lessons.
You know, Emma, you're almost at the end of your time in the Ann Arbor Public School System. This, you know, you're heading off to college in the fall. And as you think about the kind of information you got through your years in school, what was missing? What would you like to see added or changed?
So Ann Arbor Public Schools, like, I'm really lucky to go there. And my health teacher, I go to Skyline, and my health teacher, Ms. Bizu, was, like, amazing. But to me, like, I took health my sophomore year, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, I got that education that was so great, but I only got it for a week. And I got it my sophomore year, and now I'm a senior, and I'm kind of seeing that reflected in, like, it only being a one-time thing. I think that's where we're kind of, like, falling through in terms of, like, helping our students. And I think it goes back to kind of talking about consent in a broader area, because I think that, like, yes, I was taught literally consent education and I was taught literally sex education. But when it comes to things where it's not as easy, and sometimes it takes, like, maybe my teacher stepping in and being like, hey, don't make that joke, or like one of my students being comfortable enough to step in and be like, hey, that's not okay, then I feel like it falls short. And I also do think that we need more comprehensive, like, LGBTQ plus education. Mm-hmm. In our presentation that I teach in health classes, we do a presentation on it. But like I said, that's like a one-time thing, you know? So I do think that we need more comprehensive, continued LGBTQ plus education in addition to sex education.
And Wendy Sellers, I could hear you say that this is really the kind of, when we're talking about something like consent and some of just the awareness of all of this, you should be starting when? How young should these lessons start?
They should start at birth. And the reason I say that is because from birth, we need to teach our young people the proper names for their body parts so that if they do have someone touching them inappropriately, they can report that in a way that's understandable. When we teach kids cutesy names or euphemisms for their private parts, not everybody will know what those things are if a child says someone touched my whatever. Also, when children are very young, they need to be taught that they have the right to decide whether or not they give their auntie or their uncle a hug or a kiss. If they don't want to, they shouldn't be forced to do that, because all that does is teach them that they do not have a right to their own body autonomy. We need to teach kids the importance of asking for permission before they borrow someone's toy or touch someone's body, and also the importance of listening when they ask someone to borrow a toy or to give them a hug or whatever, to listen to the answer and then respect whether it's a yes or no, either way. So it needs to start very young.
We're talking about the way the Me Too movement is changing the way schools teach about sexuality and about consent, as we talk with sexual health education consultant Wendy Sellers and also with Ann Arbor High School senior Emma Davis-Rodak, who sits on the district's Sexual Health Education Advisory Board. Emma, what should adults know and understand about how sex and relationships are for kids in 2019 as compared to when mom and dad were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that comes with, like, first of all, obviously, like, the internet and cell phones. That's, like, a huge thing. And then also, like, I think with these changing cultural attitudes that are really important, and I'm really glad we have them, of like, we're kind of starting to recognize kind of what Wendy was saying about like bodily autonomy. And we're kind of starting to be like, okay, yeah, like you have a right to choose what happens, like what you do with your body, or if any contraceptives you use, like you have a right to that. So I think that adults really need to understand that even though they might not have felt that when they were younger and in their sex education, which like I'm really sorry, first of all, because that like is really hard and really terrible. But I think that they need to recognize that times are shifting and they need to trust their kids a lot more. And then I think also in terms of adults that are pushing for abstinence-only education, like especially with the internet now, people are going to get like sex education no matter what. It's just barring the quality of it. It's really easy for someone to go out there and get like not quality sex education online. What they're going to be missing, they're going to find out like what body parts are and how sex works, but they're going to be missing consent education. They're going to be missing trans-inclusive sex ed. They're going to be missing contraceptive lessons for non-hetero couples. You know, like those are important things that you learn, and it's really like it takes time to form those, and it takes like input from people in those communities. And I feel like that's what like good comprehensive sex ed needs, and that's what we're ready for as the times go on. But people need to understand that by barring students from getting sex education, those are the things they're going to be missing out on. They're going to know what sex is. They're going to know what body parts are. They're just going to be missing out on how to do it safely and how to do it inclusively.
Wendy, Ann Arbor is a pretty liberal city, but what are your thoughts about districts that are more conservative and they may only want to offer abstinence-only sex ed courses?
I think you're right. Ann Arbor is more progressive than many of the communities in Michigan. And yet all of our communities include parents and educators who care deeply about the welfare of our young people. And so I think it's important that we find the common ground and the messaging that will build trust and support for comprehensive sex ed. For example, a recent study just came out that said that young people who get comprehensive sex education, not abstinence only or sexual risk avoidance, as they're now calling it, are less likely to be victimized by sexual assault when they go to college. And so we need to find similar messages about how can we keep our young people safe and healthy and help them develop into sexually healthy adults. And those are the messages that will build support in all the communities across our state.
How do adults connect to students in an authentic way to talk about consent, to talk about sexual health, and do it in a way where the kids aren't going to be just in the back row rolling their eyes? Emma, I want you to start with that.
I mean, first of all, input from youth is really important. That's why I'm on the SHEAC committee, because like you're not going to know what's relevant to people unless you include them in it. And that goes in everything. You know, like you shouldn't be talking about like a group of people or something that affects them without direct input from those people. But I think listening to your students, trying to make it as open as possible, showing that you're not embarrassed. You know, like we always see those movie scenes of those like sex ed teachers that are super like kind of like awkward about it. And then obviously your students are going to be embarrassed about it. But I remember I got my sex ed from peer educators, like people who are my age and people who I'm now friends with.
And now you're doing this work.
Yeah, now yeah. I am doing that. But I remember like at first when I got my sex ed, I was like 15 and I was super immature, you know? And I remember thinking like, okay, there are these two students who are like literally putting like condoms on a plastic penis and they're not embarrassed at all. So like I can sit through this and I can listen and I can be mature about it. So I think just showing that you're comfortable, being really open to questions, and also maybe leaving some time like after class a lot for people to come and talk to you when they're not necessarily, it's not necessarily comfortable and safe for everyone to always raise their hand and ask questions in that space, you know?
Wendy, what would you like to add to what this this peer educator just had to say?
I think those are great points that Emma's raised. And in addition, I have, a couple dozen additional points. I personally love teaching sex ed. And so I think it's really important that when educators in a formal setting like a school are asked to teach sex ed, that they get adequate professional development to build their confidence and comfort. Equally important, parents want to do a good job, but most of us did not have good sex educator parents. And so many times parents don't know how to start. And so I've developed a lot of book lists for parents to draw from. And so either reading a book together or giving your child a book is a great way to start. It's important to start these conversations when kids are young, because then they're not self-conscious and feeling awkward. If a child grows up having these conversations repeatedly, then they sort of get used to the fact that this is a topic in their home. Using teachable moments like watching television together and talking about any sexual situations that come up, or any sexual violence situations or disrespect situations. Having the talks when you're not looking at each other, like when you're riding in the car, or if you're playing basketball or going for a walk in the woods, that can help to avoid having to sit there face to face and watch each other blush. And admit if you feel awkward about something. It is fine for adults to say, you know what, I'm feeling a little weird about this, but it is so important that I'm just going to work through that, because we really need to talk about this topic. That can help also. And then there are a lot of great resources for parents. There are great books out there giving them tips on how to get more comfortable talking with their children about consent or sexuality, and great books to share with their students.
Bottom line, what's at stake here? Why are these changes in the way we present sexual health education needed?
I mean, like, it's really easy to think about sex ed in a bubble. It's really easy to think about everything that way. But it's just, it's so much more than just like, this is what sex is. This is what like contraception is. There's so much more than just like, oh, this is how to use like a condom at stake. You know, it's being taught bodily autonomy and consent. And a lot of LGBTQ plus education, it's being taught not ableist education. It's just like everything is at stake at this point, you know?
And that, I'm sure, just infuses itself into all areas of your life. Wendy, final word to you. What's at stake here?
Well, everyone has a sexual aspect to their personhood. And how a person expresses that varies, but everyone has that aspect. And if we ignore that aspect, that would be like not teaching us how to take care of our bodies or not educating our minds. And so it's really important to deal with the sexual aspect of every person. Relationship is central to sexuality. Sex always occurs within a relationship. It may be a relationship with yourself, or it may be a relationship with someone else, but it's always about relationship. And finally, if hashtag MeToo has taught us anything, it has taught us that sexual harassment and sexual assault are epidemic. And if we ignore teaching our young people about sexuality and how to engage in consent, then we're going to just allow this to continue unchecked.
Sexual health education consultant Wendy Sellers. Her book is Puberty, The Wonder Years. And Emma Davis Rodak, a senior in the Ann Arbor Public School System, and she sits on the district's Sexual Health Education Advisory Board. Thanks to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
In 1849, a large fire threatened to destroy Windsor, Ontario. The Detroit Fire Department rushed to the aid of its Canadian neighbor. That was because just a year before, the two fire departments had agreed to assist each other in the case of such a blaze. Well, shortly after the fire, the people of Windsor presented the DFD with a gift of appreciation. Here's Madeleine Delaval, who's curator at Museum Windsor.
The silver speaking trumpet was a gift by the grateful citizens of Windsor to the Detroit firemen for their assistance in putting out the Great Fire of 1849, which almost destroyed Windsor.
Now, this silver speaking trumpet will be on display at Museum Windsor for the next 6 months. And on Tuesday, the fire chiefs of both cities and several members of their departments posed for photos at the international boundary line on both the Ambassador Bridge and inside the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel, commemorating the fire's 170th anniversary and reaffirming their cross-border partnership. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Adam Reyes, Bella Isaacs, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.